From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Chilean novelist Isabel Allende has written a new novel set in California, where she now lives. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Allende about the surprising turns her life has taken since her uncle, Salvador Allende, the president of Chile, was killed in a 1973 military coup. Also today, AIDS and drug users. We talk with Don Desjarlais. He's been studying the effectiveness of needle exchange programs in New York and the pattern of sexual transmission among drug users and their partners. Desjarlais is on the U.S. AIDS Commission and is consultant to the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tells us about the new accent in Britain that doesn't hint of class. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. House Speaker Thomas Foley predicted today the House will pass President Clinton's tax bill on Thursday. Foley said the bill would have passed this afternoon if the vote were scheduled then. The speaker was among Democratic lawmakers who met with President Clinton at the White House today as the president tried to shore up support for his plan to raise taxes and cut the deficit. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
House leaders insist they will have the votes to pass the president's tax plan, although indications are they are still several dozen votes short of the 218 they need. In an effort to win over the remaining holdouts, leaders are working on an agreement to give conservatives and moderates not the caps on mandatory spending they've been seeking, but an end-of-year review to ensure that spending targets are not overshot. House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt.
The best name for it is a budget review mechanism that would require both the President and the Congress to address situations where budget projections in terms of spending are breached.
House leaders say today's meeting with the President helped swing momentum behind the tax bill. Debate on the measure and a vote are set for Thursday. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The South African government has arrested at least 73 leaders of a militant black nationalist group on charges that the group is linked to mass shootings of white civilians. The Pan-Africanist Congress reacted to the arrest by walking out of the latest round of power-sharing talks with the white minority government. The African National Congress said the arrests could jeopardize the political negotiations. The PAC is a militant offshoot of the ANC that claims the support of about 5% of South Africa's black people. Its membership is believed to be composed mostly of radical youth. Consumer confidence dropped in May, according to the monthly survey by the Conference Board. NPR's John Idsty reports.
The Conference Board survey showed that Americans are far less optimistic about the economy's future performance than they were only a month ago. The Consumer Confidence Index fell to 61.5 in May. That's down from over 67 in April and far below the post-election peak of more than 78 recorded in December. According to the Conference Board, consumers are especially concerned about job prospects as unemployment continues at high levels for a recovery. Only 13% of those surveyed by the Conference Board in May said they believe more jobs will be available in the coming months. Also, fewer people said that business conditions will improve, and more said they expect their incomes to decline. The drop in consumer confidence is troubling because consumer spending accounts for two-thirds of the nation's economic activity. I'm John Idsty in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 9 points to close at 3,516. This is NPR. The UN Security Council is scheduled to vote soon on setting up a court to try war crimes committed in the former Yugoslavia. If it's approved, the court would be the first international war crimes tribunal since the Nuremberg and Tokyo trials after World War II. The effort to identify and try war criminals is the first element of the latest Western strategy in Bosnia. The Environmental Protection Agency says American factories achieved a sizable reduction in toxic emissions, about 9% from 1990 to 1991. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
All told, the EPA says U.S. manufacturing facilities released about 3.3 billion pounds of toxic chemicals into the environment in 1991. That compares to nearly 3.6 billion pounds the year before. The report is called the Toxic Release Inventory. Under the Community Right to Know law, manufacturing and chemical companies are required to measure how much of some 300 chemicals they're emitting into the environment. The EPA releases the information to the public. Officials say companies may be reducing their emissions to avoid being branded as polluters. The EPA also plans to add 200 chemicals to the list of substances companies are required to report. But the agency says there is one disturbing trend. Preliminary data indicate that even though emissions are going down, the amount of waste that needs to be disposed of probably increased in 1992. This is Philip Davis reporting.
Lawyers for suspended Miami police officer William Lozano rested their case today without calling a single witness in his defense. Lozano is being retried for manslaughter in a case that charges he used unnecessary force in the shooting death of a black motorcycle driver and the death of his passenger in the crash that followed. The incident set off 3 days of rioting in 1989. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chilean writer Isabella Allende has said she divides her life before and after September 11, 1973. That was the day a military junta overthrew the Marxist government headed by her uncle, Salvador Allende, who was killed during the coup. She stayed in Chile after the coup, working with the underground, then fled to Venezuela. In Chile, she'd been a journalist. It wasn't until she was 39 years old that she started writing fiction. Her novels, The House of the Spirits of Love and Shadows and Eva Luna, are set in Latin America. But her new novel, The Infinite Plan, is her first set in the United States. She's lived in California since 1988, when she married an American. Her new novel is about the son of an itinerant preacher who has created a metaphysical religion he calls The Infinite Plan. Allende's interest in unusual expressions of spirituality is connected to her grandmother, who was a spiritualist.
My grandmother was a wonderful character, and she's the character of my first novel, The House of the Spirits. Actually, they're making a movie now, and Meryl Streep is my grandmother in the movie. So I feel honored that I have such a grandmother. In real life, she was always experimenting with telepathy and trying to move objects without touching them. Actually, telepathy worked much better than the Chilean telephone company.
Did she hold seances?
Yes, every Thursday.
And you went to them?
I was very, very young, but I do remember part of it. My grandfather, who was a pragmatic Basque, opposed all this. But then one day my grandmother decided that it was not the souls of the dead that moved the three-legged table, but maybe extraterrestrials. Now that was scientific. So my grandfather accepted the seances, and then I could see them.
Well, do you remember what it was like to be at one of her seances?
Yeah, it was always at daylight. It was nothing. There was nothing spooky about it. Very open and funny. And she had three friends who were just as crazy as she was. And they communicated with spirits, they thought.
Do you think of yourself as being a spiritual person?
It's too much, too big a word, spiritual. But I'm aware that I'm not only mind and body, that there is something else. And in my recent experience, I had a daughter who was very, very sick, and she recently died. I think that I have come much deeper into that sense of the soul, that there is a lot there.
You spent a lot of time with her when she was dying.
Yeah, she was with her. I was with her for a year. She was in coma for a year, and I had her at home. And then she died in my arms, and that changed my life and my perspective of life.
Right. This happened in the United States?
Yes. It happened in December.
Oh, it was very recent. I didn't realize it was that recent.
Yes, it's very recent.
Living in the United States and being around English-speaking people a lot of the time, is that a strain for you?
I'm another person in English. The basic things in my life are always in Spanish, like food and making love. I would feel ridiculous panting in English or writing fiction in English.
Can you be funny in English?
No. I can't be funny. That's the worst. But I can be really funny in Spanish, you know. I'm very oral in Spanish, and I can really be funny.
They say that's what I imagine is such a strain when you're in when you're in a culture in which that isn't your native tongue. I mean, can you be funny with your husband who's American?
He speaks Spanish.
Oh.
And but I think he doesn't get it quite well. Sometimes I try to make a joke and he doesn't get it. But it doesn't matter. He gets other stuff, so it's okay. And he can make love in Spanish. I suppose it's very stressful for him, but he can. He tries at least.
Have you been back to Chile since the end of the Pinochet regime?
Yes, I go back every year, except last year when my daughter was sick. I've been back every year.
What was the first time you were back?
Oh, I can't tell you. When I left my country, it was a winter day, and I was running away without my family, and I was very scared. And then many years later, I returned in a radiant summer day with Willie, my new husband. And there was a crowd waiting for me in the airport. It's like a metaphor of my life. My life goes up and down. I'm always pushed to the limits.
And when you returned, was that after the Pinochet regime?
Yes. It was. Well, it was for the plebiscite.
Oh, so you returned during the election?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess you were really hoping for the best.
I think that everybody knew that we would get rid of the dictatorship. Chile is a very original country. It chose in a popular democratic election the first Marxist socialist president in the world.
Your uncle?
My uncle. And it got rid of a dictatorship without violence, also with a democratic election.
What was it like for you when your uncle Salvador Allende was elected president in 1970? How did that affect your status in your own culture?
It didn't affect it at all. I was not involved in politics at the time. And Salvador Allende was a member of an extended family for me. I wasn't so close to him as I was to... Well, actually, he was a very good friend of my stepfather. So in that sense, we were closer.
No, he was the brother of...
He was the cousin of
father.
My father.
The cousin of your father?
Yeah, he was the cousin of my father. But when my father disappeared when I was very young, he remained very close to my mother. So I was brought up seeing him often, him and his family, sharing picnics and vacations and that kind of thing, but never involved in politics, really. When he was elected, I wasn't even aware of what had happened, really. I would just went on with my job. I really became aware of the historical figure that he had become after the coup and after I left Chile, because everybody was talking about it, and he seemed to have this historical dimension that I was not aware of.
When you say that your father disappeared when you were young, do you mean that he just left the family?
Yes.
And didn't keep in touch, or was there something more mysterious than that?
There was something mysterious that I don't know what it is, and my mother won't say. I imagine that he did something terrible, but I don't know what it was. And he was never in touch with us again. I never saw him. All his photographs were destroyed. And many years later, when I was 26 years old, I was called to the morgue to identify a body, and that's the only time I ever saw him.
Oh, and it was his body?
It was his body. He died in the street of a heart attack. And they called me because they found his papers, and they wanted someone from Allende's family to identify the body. But I couldn't because I had never seen him. I had never even seen a picture of him. So I called my stepfather, and he knew him, and he identified him. So we buried him.
Well, gee.
Soap opera.
Really?
A soap opera.
Really? So you went to look at the body even though you knew you wouldn't recognize him, but this was your chance to see him.
No, I went to look for the body because he had my brother's name, and I thought it was my brother because at that time my brother was in a cult and we hadn't seen him for a year.
Your brother was in a cult?
For a time, yes. Fortunately, he got out of it.
What kind of cult was it?
Some guy from Argentina that called Silo, and he made up that name. And he invented some sort of religion in which he was the new Messiah, a little bit like David Koresh, but less threatening, probably.
So did your brother leave the cult?
He left it, but he was 6 years there,
wow.
A long time.
Uh-huh.
So at the time, when I was looking for him, I stumbled upon the dead body of my father.
What was your mother's reaction to your father's death?
She hadn't seen him for a very long time, and I don't know what happened between them, but she was very sad. She felt very sad.
So you said that you weren't really very political until after the coup. after the coup and after the assassination of your uncle in 1973. As soon as the coup happened, well, how did you find out about the coup? Where were you and how did you hear about it?
Well, like everybody else did, I was at home and I was getting ready to go to my office. I took the car. I didn't have a radio in the car. And I was driving to my office and I saw that the streets were empty. The only vehicles that you saw were military trucks and tanks. And people had been talking about a coup for a long time, but we had no experience in such a thing because Chile had been the longest democracy in Latin America. So we thought that military coups only happen in banana republics. And so I wasn't even scared. I thought, what is this? And I just went on driving. And I reached my office and I found the building closed and a soldier at the door. And they told me that there was a military coup and I should go back home. But I stopped in a friend's house and she told me that her husband had left very early in the morning and had gone to a school where he was a teacher downtown. And there was no transportation for him to come back. So I went downtown to pick him up, and that's how I saw the bombardment of the palace, and I was very close when it happened.
Were you endangered by virtue of being a member of the Allende family?
I don't think so. I think that I could have stayed in Chile if I had not gotten involved in activities that were forbidden by the regime. At the beginning, right after the coup, the Mexican embassy offered a plane to take the family out of the country, and actually, those who were not in prison or dead left, and they lived in exile in Mexico or in Cuba or in other countries for many years. But at the time, I didn't think that it was necessary to leave. I thought that we had no tradition in military coups. The soldiers would go back to their barracks very soon, and we would have elections again. So I stayed, and as soon as the curfew was lifted after 48 hours, I realized that some of my friends were hiding, and that people needed help, and I did what many other people did because we didn't know the rules, and there are no rules in terror. I just helped as much as I could, and then I got more and more involved, and there was a point where the circle of repression was just closing around my neck.
What was the type of thing that you did to help?
Hide people, find asylum, smuggle information out of the country.
Where would you hide people?
In my house or in other people's houses. We have to move them every night.
Did you have a taste for the kind of risk and danger that this entailed?
I didn't have an idea of what I was doing. When I learned the risk that it involved, I was terrified because it was not only me, it was also my family that was in danger. You know, at that time, they were torturing children in front of their parents to force them to confess. And actually, when you do this kind of thing, there's nothing that you can confess because you don't know the names of the people you're hiding. You keep them only for one night. So it's part of a network of people who are doing this kind of activity. And it's organized in such a way that you're not supposed to know much.
So did you decide to leave when you did, in part because you were afraid of the rest of your family?
I was afraid for myself, the rest of the family. I was threatened. And I had some contacts, people who knew me and were kind enough to tell me that I was in danger. So maybe I was not, but who can tell? I mean, it's so difficult to know what you have to do or if there is a real risk or not. And anyhow, I thought there was a moment when I was just terrified and I thought that I couldn't stand anymore.
How did you get out?
With a passport on a plane. Early in the morning, I just left, terrified, because I thought I might be stopped in the airport.
Well, sure, if your name was on a list, that would be a logical thing to think.
Yeah, but it wasn't so well organized.
Mm-hmm. So did you stay involved with the Chilean resistance after you left Chile?
To a certain extent, but I was at a level of survival when I left. I didn't have a visa, I didn't have money, I didn't have a job, I didn't have friends. So at the time, I was also angry at myself because I had put myself in that situation. And when I went to Venezuela, I really needed, first of all, to find a job and a place to stay and wait for my kids. I mean, I missed my kids and my husband.
Do you think that your whole personality changed by virtue of what you saw in Chile?
Yes, not only mine, but I think practically everybody in Chile changed. First of all, you could not remain neutral. You have to have a position. for or against the dictatorship. And whatever that position was determined your future life. And my position was very clear. I was against it. And for a while, I was willing to take all the risks. Then later, I wasn't. I was much more of a coward than I ever thought I was.
Well, do you consider it a sign of cowardice or a sign of just realism that you left when you did?
Many people who were just as realistic as I was stayed and took the risk.
So on the one hand, you're angry with yourself for having stayed when because you didn't realize that the coup would really last. On the other hand, you're angry with yourself for having left.
You know, that's what the dictatorship achieved, to make the victims feel guilty.
No matter what you do.
No matter what you do.
Writer Isabel Allende is my guest. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Isabel Allende. Her new novel is called The Infinite Plan. So you had been, I think, a journalist when you were
yes.
in Chile. And then I think you were about 39 or something when you actually started writing fiction. What happened in the intervening years?
Paralysis, total emotional paralysis. I couldn't do anything. I did all sorts of odd jobs to support my family. I couldn't write because I didn't know that I could write fiction at the time. I was trying to work as a journalist and couldn't get a job as a journalist. I never adapted in Venezuela, although Venezuela is a very generous and open country. I was always looking south, wanting to go back and with my suitcases packed.
So after all these odd jobs, you started writing fiction?
Yeah, I think that for many years I had all these unwritten events like stored somewhere, suffocating me. And then one day, it was January 8th, 1981, we received a phone call from Chile saying that my grandfather was dying. And I decided to write him a sort of spiritual letter. And I started writing, and I went on writing and writing, and I could never stop. I wrote every night for a year, and then I had 500 pages on my table. And my mother said, this doesn't look like a letter anymore. It's probably a book. And that was The House of the Spirits. So it's amazing to see how now they're making this super production, this great movie, with something that started in such a humble way.
You're among Latin America's best-known women writers.
I hope that someday someone will drop the women word. And I will be just a good writer, for heaven's sake.
Oh, no, no. But what I was leading to was, do you think it's been any harder for you or for other women to get published in Latin America? Do you think that that there are obstacles you face that a male counterpart would not?
Yes, I definitely think so. In a male chauvinist patriarchal society, women are supposed to be silent. They should not be creative because it's dangerous for the structure of the society if they speak up. And writing is the most visible way of speaking up. And women have been condemned to silence for 500 years in my continent, and they still are. More and more women are writing, more of them are being published, and now even some movies are being made with some women writers, like The Official History like Water for Chocolate and many others.
Do you feel that you were condemned to silence as a young woman or
yes.
as a girl?
Yes. I didn't receive an education. I was not supposed to be anything else but a housewife and a mother and a good wife, if possible. I had to work all my life, and I like it, and I really enjoyed being a journalist. But I never went to the university. I did not finish high school. And my brothers, on the other hand, were stimulated and even forced to have an education because they were men.
When did you actually become aware of that double standard?
When I was 5 years old, and I remember exactly the moment.
What was it?
I was sitting in the living room in my grandfather's house with my mother, and she was trying to teach me to knit. And through the window, I could see my brothers climbing a tree. And then I was there trying to pass the yarn through these needles. And my mother said, sit with your legs crossed like a lady. And I realized that I not only had to be doing this thing, which I hated, but I also had to be sitting in an uncomfortable position while my brothers were climbing the tree. And I wanted to be a man. I wanted to be like my grandfather, like my brothers, not like my mom.
Did you do anything to rebel against the feminine role that they had scripted for you?
Yes, always. But I got a lot of aggression, and I could not articulate that anger. I didn't know that it had a name, it had a language, it had a way of expressing it and changing those rules. I was just very angry, very rebellious, and I got a lot of aggression. And then when I was old enough to work in a magazine, in a woman's magazine, my friends who were writing in this radical feminist magazine were reading North American feminists in translation. And I started reading those books, and I realized that they were years ahead and that they had a language and they could articulate these thoughts even with humor, with irony. And I thought, God, it was like a revelation.
Who were you reading?
Well, Gloria Steinem, Germaine Greer. I remember The Female Eunuch changed my life. It gave me a language to express what I was feeling.
So once you had the language, how did you use it?
I was a feminist journalist all my career. I had a feminist humorous column in a magazine and then a TV show every week. I would make fun of men, and men loved it, actually. But it was a very feminist way of expressing it.
So what did that do to your reputation, being a feminist?
I had the reputation of being a raging feminist, but because I used humor, I was forgiven, in a way.
Were you married already?
Yes, I was married, and my husband and nobody else took me really seriously.
It's funny, a lot of relationships that started before a woman kind of realized the inequities of gender ended up falling apart because the marriage was based on an unequal relationship, and once the woman demanded equality, discovered that her husband wasn't the right person, or her boyfriend wasn't the right person.
It wasn't that way with me, actually, because as I said before, I had always been very angry and very rebellious, mm-hmm. even if I couldn't articulate it. So right. When I met my husband, he knew how I felt, and I think he was the right person for a while. And what really destroyed our marriage was not the fact that I was a feminist, because I had always been one, but exile. I think that happened to many, many families, that once they were away from the support of the group and the social rules that keep you together, and you are naked in front of each other, alone in a foreign place, trying to survive, then you realize who the other person is, essentially. And sometimes you fall out of love.
Yeah. You're living in California, where there's a lot of Spanish culture. Do you feel any kind of connection to the California aspects of Spanish culture?
Yes, and that's what my new book is about. It's about this love-hate relationship between Anglos and Latins that has been going on for so long. And it's about my privileged position as a person who has a foot in each culture and can speak both languages and can understand the fears of both.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And my guest has been Isabel Allende. Her new novel is called The Infinite Plan. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, why it's so difficult to stop the spread of HIV among drug users. We talk with Don Desjarlais. He's been studying AIDS and drugs for 10 years and serves on the U.S. AIDS Commission. He's currently evaluating the effectiveness of the needle exchange program in New York. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us about Britain's new classless accent. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Guatemala's president has introduced a series of emergency measures, suspending constitutional rights, introducing censorship, and dissolving the country's Congress and Supreme Court. From Guatemala City, NPR's Tom Gibb reports.
Guatemalans awoke to hear all the radio stations playing marimba music, which is the traditional way to announce a coup. Soon after, however, President Serrano gave a national broadcast. He promised the measures were temporary and said there would be elections for a constituent assembly to reform the constitution within 60 days. He said he had taken this action out of desperation at the inability of the government to combat drug trafficking and corruption. Although the measures are almost certainly with the support of the powerful armed forces, there's very little military presence on the streets. The city is crowded with people going about their daily business. So far, there have been no reports of violence. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in Guatemala City.
A former NATO commander says that there is a 50-50 chance that the current fighting in Bosnia will spread to other areas. Retired General John Galvin told the House Armed Services Committee today that he thinks that Serbian factions will not stop with Bosnia, but will go elsewhere, and he indicated his concern about plans to create safe havens in the region. Galvin said that Western allies must make it clear that if the fighting goes outside of Bosnia, then the world will take action. He also said to confine the fighting would require U.S. ground troops and air attacks, along with other allied forces. In New York City today, the U.N. prevented a leading Chinese dissident from entering its headquarters to give a news conference. U.N. Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali refused to allow the dissident to meet with reporters, apparently after pressure from the Chinese government. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports from New York.
Shen Teng was a leading force in the Tiananmen Square student uprising in 1989, the same year he was voted one of Newsweek magazine's Men of the Year. But Boutros-Ghali refused to allow him to hold a news conference in the press club at UN headquarters, offering instead a building across the street, an offer refused by reporters. Today, Shen Teng denounced the decision.
It makes me seriously doubt about the UN stand on this issue, which is an increasingly crucial issue for the whole world, namely human rights.
Until today, there had been an unhindered tradition of allowing dissidents to speak at the UN press club. In future, the UN says correspondents must submit for approval the names of speakers deemed controversial. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 9 points to close at 3,516.63 on volume of more than 222 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. Officials at the White House say that there will be an internal study of the travel office firings last week. A spokesman now says only two travel office employees with financial authority were fired, and five others were placed on administrative leave and thus are being paid. Last week, the White House said all seven were fired. A spokesman says the internal study of the matter is separate from an FBI probe of alleged financial wrongdoing in the travel office and will focus on how the entire affair was handled. Another hanging death has occurred in a Mississippi jail. Officials say this one, like 47 others over the last 6 years, is a suicide. But there are indications of negligence. NPR's David Mopus reports.
The Jackson Police Department today suspended indefinitely a guard at the city jail, one day after an inmate was found dead in his cell, hanging by a bedsheet. Officials say the inmate, 19-year-old Timothy Lindsay, was considered a suicide risk because of statements he had made after his arrest Saturday on murder charges. A police spokesperson says Lindsay should have been checked on more regularly by the guard, at least once an hour, but apparently the inmate was left alone for longer periods. The hanging comes amidst a new investigation of Mississippi jails ordered by Attorney General Janet Reno. Critics allege that some of the deaths may in fact be homicides, but so far state and federal agencies have found no evidence to support that theory. The state does have the sixth highest jail suicide rate in the nation. I'm David Malpas reporting.
A border policeman in Egypt apparently by mistake fired on a tourist bus, wounding three tourists. The shootings occurred in the southern part of Egypt after a minibus crossed into a restricted area. Tourist travel to Egypt has suffered over the last year because of attacks there by extremists. Among those injured in shots fired by the border guard were three Australians and one Briton. Since the attack started, tourist income in Egypt has dropped by a third. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Stopping the spread of AIDS among drug users is very difficult. For over 10 years, my guest Don Desjarlais has been studying HIV transmission among drug users. Desjarlais is the research director at the Chemical Dependency Institute of Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. He serves on the National Commission on AIDS and consults on AIDS to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the Centers for Disease Control, and the World Health Organization. I asked him if the largest population in which AIDS is still spreading is intravenous drug users.
It's a very close estimate. We don't really have data as good as we should have on new HIV infections, but it is either very close between men having sex with men, particularly young men having sex with older men, and people who share drug injection equipment.
Mm-hmm. Among IV drug users, is AIDS spreading because drug users don't know about this, about the spread of AIDS, or because when they need a fix, they don't care?
Neither. Uh-huh. Really, neither of those reasons. First, essentially everybody in the U.S. Who can read or listen to TV knows about AIDS, and drug users are very interested in AIDS and very concerned about it. They know about AIDS. They want to practice safer injection. Many of them want to come into drug abuse treatment, but we don't have the treatment capacity to take them. Those that are not in treatment want to practice safe injection. The greatest difficulty is really the limited availability of clean injection equipment.
Well, there have been needle exchange programs set up experimentally in some cities around the country. I believe you're evaluating the needle exchange program in New York now.
Yes, I'm leading the study that's evaluating the New York syringe exchange programs.
Where are you on that study? Is there any preliminary evaluation you could share with us?
Yes, we have data from the first 6 months of the legal operation. And these programs went from an underground semi-legal status to a fully legal status last summer. With that move to fully legal status, they increased the number of people they were providing services to from about 1,000 prior to legalization to about 6,000 to 7,000 now. So that there's been a very substantial increase in the number of people reached, and there have been substantial decreases in sharing of injection equipment among people using the syringe exchange.
You've been working on drug-related research and drug-related policy for a long time. Do you think the needle exchange programs and the success that they seem like they're having is changing the attitude of drug policymakers in America?
It's changing. It's not rapid change, but it's certainly changing. The number of legally authorized syringe exchanges is growing exponentially. It's still rather small, but it's clearly been growing exponentially over the last two or three years. There is more interest in Congress, more interested in the federal government in getting out of the way of syringe exchanges. Up until the last several years, Congress and the administration were actively blocking syringe exchange efforts. Now there's at least a move towards neutrality.
I know that some people are recommending that AIDS awareness and education campaigns be targeted to high-risk groups as opposed to spreading the money, time, and effort behind those campaigns in a more random way. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, clearly everyone in the United States ought to have some version of AIDS 101, basic AIDS education, how the virus is transmitted, how the virus is not transmitted to reduce unreasonable fears, the need to develop a sense of compassion for people with HIV infection and to not discriminate against people who have HIV infection. But in terms of preventing new HIV infections, we can do a reasonable job of identifying where those new infections are most likely to occur. We can identify it by age group, by behaviors, by background seroprevalence in the area, so that if we can focus some of our efforts on where the large number of new HIV infections is occurring, we can do a lot to reduce that number of new infections. Currently, the best estimate is that there are 40,000 to 80,000 new HIV infections per year. With sufficient prevention resources, we should be able to cut that in half at least.
Well, since you're focusing on drug users, besides needle exchange programs, what are some of the focuses that you could help think could help with prevention?
Well, the U.S. National Commission and the previous Presidential Commission called for immediate availability of drug abuse treatment, that anybody who had a drug problem could show up at a treatment program and receive services that same day. Right now, in many places, including in the Northeast, if you apply for drug abuse treatment, you're typically told, we'll take your application and we'll call you back in 2 or 3 months when we have an opening. If we're going to be serious about preventing AIDS and preventing tuberculosis associated with AIDS, we really do need to be able to provide immediate access to drug abuse treatment.
How much progress are you making in that direction?
Painfully slow. Over the last several years, there has been modest increases in federal funds for drug abuse treatment that slowly trickle their way down to the localities. But because so many state governments and city governments are in such bad financial shape, they've been reducing the money allocated at the state and local levels almost as fast as the federal government has been increasing the funds for drug abuse treatment at the federal level. So there's been extremely modest net gains.
Are you personally recommending shifting money away from law enforcement to prevention?
Well, I think that there's really close to a consensus that a lot of the money spent on interdiction, of trying to seal the borders, sending up radar balloons and such, is essentially doing no good at all, and that money could be much better spent in terms of reducing demand, of developing effective prevention programs to keep people from getting started and into drug use problems in the first place, and providing treatment for people who have drug problems to stop those problems.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Don Desjarlais. He's director of research at the Chemical Dependency Institute at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. He also sits on the U.S. Commission on AIDS. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the spread of AIDS among drug users, and my guest, Don Desjarlais, is the director of research at the Chemical Dependency Institute at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. He sits on the AIDS Commission and also consults to the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization. I think it's fair to say that in the population of female drug users, there's a sizable number of women who end up turning to prostitution when they're out of money and they need a fix. Is there a lot of AIDS being spread through drug-related prostitution?
Actually, the amount of HIV being spread through drug-related prostitution is really rather modest. Most females who inject drugs and turn to prostitution have a sense of professionalism about their activity. They are likely to strongly encourage their customers to use condoms, and a substantial amount of that sexual activity is also oral sex, which is a less efficient way of transmitting the virus. The biggest problem in drug use-related prostitution and transmission of HIV is probably around crack use. where the people exchanging sex for crack do not have the same sense of professionalism about their activity that other workers in the sex industry do. And the use of condoms is much less, and the volume of sexual activity can be much higher. So it's actually in sort of the crack house setting that once HIV gets into the that type of setting, that you're more likely to see higher levels of HIV transmission than in the traditional heroin-injecting street prostitute.
Now, the whole issue for lawmakers has been, is it condoning drug use if you allow a needle exchange program to legally operate, or if you allow, if you turn your back on a shooting gallery as long as they're, you know, bleaching their needles and trying to prevent against AIDS? What do you think of that whole condoning controversy?
Well, I think condoning is a very, very slippery term, and it doesn't have any scientific meaning, any meaning that you can study in a research project. Clearly, at a policy level, doing syringe exchange work means that you're recognizing that illicit drugs are injected, and that you're recognizing that there are very serious health problems associated with that, and that you need to address those health problems, and you cannot wait until you found a solution to eliminate illicit drug injection before you address the health problems. So it's simply saying that we're not condoning this, but we're recognizing that it exists, and we're recognizing that it's a serious community problem, that the health consequences are extremely serious, and that we have to address those health consequences and reduce the harm associated with illicit drug injection. And we have to do that right now, that we can't wait until we've evolved into some future society that doesn't inject illicit drugs.
Have you studied any other countries and how they're approaching the spread of AIDS among drug users?
I've probably studied about 30 or 40 other countries.
Which country has the best program, one that you would like to see us model a program on, any?
Probably Australia, mm-hmm. where they became very concerned about the possibility of HIV infection among their drug injectors. They had seen in the epidemic starting, and they essentially did everything. They changed their laws to permit over-the-counter sales of injection equipment. They set up very large numbers of syringe exchanges, and they greatly expanded the system of drug abuse treatment. Consequently, they've kept their HIV infection rate among drug injectors down to under 5% in all of their major cities, so that they really have escaped the type of HIV epidemic among drug injectors that we've seen here in the northeastern U.S. or in Spain or Italy.
How much of a drug problem is there in Australia?
It's substantial. Overall, on a per capita basis, it's probably close to the United States.
What's your evaluation so far of the Clinton administration and its posture toward AIDS and drug use?
Still sort of waiting for something to happen. There have been minor positive sounds, and there's been inaction on a number of points. The drug budget that they submitted to Congress was essentially just a Xerox of the previous administration one, and the report was that they didn't have time to think through the issues, and it clearly looks like they did not think through the issues, but it's still something of a waiting to see what happens. Lee Brown was appointed to head the Drug Czar office, and there are many people waiting to see what his policies will be, how he will allocate money to be spent to address the problem.
You're on the AIDS Commission. You consult to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the Centers for Disease Control, and the World Health Organization. Do you feel that you have a particular message you're trying to give the groups that you're affiliated with?
Yes, it's basically a two-part message, that the problem of HIV infection among drug users is too big to ignore. It may be politically uncomfortable to pay attention to it, but it's simply too big to ignore, and it will grow bigger if attention is not paid to it. And secondly, there's overwhelming evidence that drug injectors will change their behavior in response to AIDS, and that the important work is to make sure that they have the means available for changing their behavior.
What's your next project, do you know?
Well, we will be looking at sort of the continued dynamics of HIV transmission over the long haul. And also spending more effort looking at ways to encourage safer sex among people who are infected with HIV in order to reduce the heterosexual transmission.
And what are the obstacles you face there?
People in love don't want to use condoms. It is not too difficult to get people, whether they're homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, whether they do or do not use drugs, to use condoms in sort of their casual sexual relationships. But in the long-term, primary, committed sexual relationships, there seems to be very, very great emotional difficulties in using condoms. And that's where we need to do much more work to prevent heterosexual transmission.
Now, how'd you find that out?
Talking with a lot of people who should be practicing safer sex at higher levels than they are, from gay men to heterosexual drug injectors to female sexual partners who don't inject drugs in the U.S. and Europe and Asia. It's really a very common finding throughout the world that love and condoms don't mix very well.
What have your greatest frustrations been in trying to prevent the spread of AIDS among drug users?
Political denial of the problem, or political inertia. I mean, it's really much easier to get drug users to change their behavior than to get politicians to change their behavior.
Is it frustrating to you that drug use isn't going down?
Yes. I mean, it's going down in some ways, it's going up in others. But that's the type of frustration that you can say, well, the human nervous system seems to be designed to like certain types of drugs. And there isn't any way we can quickly redesign the human nervous system so that we may be in a situation of trying to design social policies to realize the human vulnerability to drug problems and to limit the damage that those drug problems will create for us. But that short of redesigning the human nervous system, we are probably not going to have societies in which psychoactive drugs are not used.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, fine. Nice talking with you.
Don Desjarlais is research director at the Chemical Dependency Institute of Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. This is Fresh Air. The president of Guatemala has disbanded the Congress and suspended constitutional rights. Linda Wertheimer, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have a reporter on his way to Guatemala City, and we'll have a report from him as soon as he gets there. We're also talking to other people about what has happened there today, and there's been some reaction at the White House to President Serrano's decision to suspend constitutional rights. We also have a story on an attempt to ban assault rifles in Connecticut, which is showing a surprising amount of support. And the papers of Mr. Justice Thurgood Marshall have been released at the Library of Congress. We'll have more on the controversy surrounding the papers and what's in them.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In many countries, the way you speak reveals your class. But there are reports of a new accent emerging in England, one that is supposed to cross over classes. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has been listening, but he's not convinced.
For most of her tenure, Mrs. Thatcher never spoke about class, except when she talked about opponents who were stirring up class rivalries with the politics of envy. But her successor, John Major, has promised to eliminate class differences in favor of a society based on pure merit. In March, for example, he announced that the Queen's honors list would henceforth include people from the lower rungs of society, firefighters, secretaries, and the like. And now, as if to vindicate Major's program, the British press has suddenly discovered a new accent, touted as heralding the end of class snobbery in British speech. They call it Estuary English because it seems to have arisen among Londoners who moved to the new bedroom communities around the mouth of the Thames in Essex and Kent. It's a kind of gentrified Cockney. Speakers of Estuary English don't usually drop their H's, but they do replace the T's at the end of the words with glottal stops. There's a lot of it about. and they sound their L's so far back in their mouths that they start to merge with W's. Can you sell me a pail of milk? Actually, there's nothing particularly new about the accent. It began in the upper classes as a kind of linguistic slumming in the swinging London of the 60s, when the smart young things started to color their speech with a slight working-class tinge. Mick Jagger must have picked up this accent when he was a student at the London School of Economics. And this accent began to coalesce with a softened Cockney that was forming in the mouths of all those upwardly mobile Londoners who were moving to the suburbs, the accent you can hear from Michael Caine. Then the accent got a big boost in the 80s when it became a kind of badge among the young traders on the frenzied floors of London's financial markets. Nowadays, you can hear it from the younger announcers on the BBC, and there are even traces of it in the speech of Princess Diana, though it's unlikely that a glottal stop will ever occlude the throat of Prince Charles. Not surprisingly, the accents met with a certain indignation from some of the older debenture holders. There was a letter a couple of weeks ago in the London Times that called the spread of estuary English horrifying and reviled the idiots on radio and television who speak English like the dregs of humanity. Of course, that's just the reaction the accent's supposed to provoke, at least for the young upper-class speakers who've taken it up. It's a way of tweaking pater and mater. Accent is a lot like dress, after all. People choose it for the impression it will make on their friends and family, not on some strangers 20 miles off. There's no question that something's going on in British speech, as the extremes in class and regional accents are being mitigated. But this isn't a sign that the nation is moving to a uniform classless speech, much less to a classless society. It would be well to remember that under Thatcher and Major, the gap between rich and poor in Britain has widened even more than it did in America during the Reagan-Bush years. What's happened, rather, is that class is becoming a more subtle business than it used to be. It's no longer signaled by the gross differences in dress and accent that set the classes apart 75 or 150 years ago, a time when Disraeli could describe the rich and poor as the two nations. Englishmen of different classes can meet socially now without going through the exquisitely painful dance of deference and condescension that's enacted, say, in the scene in Howard's End where the working-class Leonard Bassett takes tea with the upper-middle-class Schlegel sisters. The rise of estuary English is part of a wider democratization of superficial style. The Etonians are wearing jeans and Doc Martens now, and young East Enders are showing up for work in the city in Armani suits. But you wonder how much of this is for public consumption. Do they take off their accents with their clothes? I suspect that if you wake up Mick Jagger and Michael Caine in the middle of the night, they'll sound a lot more different from each other than when they're talking to Barbara Walters. Estuary English is a way of paying the classless society exactly what it deserves at the moment, pure lip service.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Susan Stamberg, who helped put All Things Considered and National Public Radio on the map. Also, practical aesthetics for actors. We talk with W.H. Macy about the acting techniques he developed with David Mamet. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.